Hi, you're tuned to Truth News Radio Australia on the 25th of April, 2014. My name's Hereward Fenton. It's a great pleasure to be with you today, ladies and gentlemen, and we are going to be, for the next 2 hours, ploughing through some very interesting material indeed. In the second hour, I am to be joined by Josh Jackson, and we are going to have a wide-ranging discussion on a variety of topics that kind of interconnect and cross over each other. We're going to be talking about Bitcoin. We're going to be talking about the future of currencies and cryptocurrencies. We're also going to be talking about biometrics and surveillance. And there is a very, very strong crossover between those two topics because increasingly we're seeing biometrics being used as a way of tracking the movement of currencies and the integration of people with the financial system is one which is subject to the sort of control that we don't like, because it is not about freedom and it is not about a free market. It is about surveillance and limiting people's options, and it's also very closely linked to the Big Brother state and police monitoring and interference in people's basic rights and freedoms. The whole question of identification is one which needs to be really looked at with a more deep philosophical perspective, and that's something I also want to do in today's show. In the first hour, I want to talk to you a lot about the concept of identification and what it really means and why it's important, and indeed whether it is as important as we are led to believe by the forces who are somewhat creating the police state that we see in many advanced Western countries, the new technocratic scientific police state, where every aspect of our lives is being monitored, and not just monitored, but often as a pretext for making arrests, for preemptive crime fighting, as they like to call it. But really, what's it all about? It's about complete control of humanity. So that is going to be a large theme of today's show. I'm also going to bring you in the second half hour of today's show some excerpts from a recent debate between Clive Palmer and Ross Garnaut, a very famous figure with the Labour Party who authored one of their primary documents that they used to forge their climate change policies. Clive Palmer and Ross Garnaut did a debate on ABC television just a couple of weeks ago, and I'm going to play some of that to you, and I'm going to give you some of my commentary on that. Okay, without further ado, let's get into the substance of today's show. Now, I had a chance to watch an excellent documentary recently, which you can find on YouTube, and I'll put the show notes, I'll put it into the show notes for today's show. It's called Panopticon. It's a Dutch documentary made by Peter Vlemmix, and it is actually in Dutch, but it has subtitles. Now, I would love to play some of it for you, but there probably wouldn't be much point since it is in Dutch. But I do highly recommend it. And I must say, I was slightly gobsmacked to discover the degree of surveillance that is going on in Holland, which I assume is typical of many countries in Western Europe, which I had thought were somewhat more of a bastion of freedom than is obviously the case. I mean, we see people are required to do biometric identification in order to buy alcohol. We see psychiatrists forced to provide personal details of their patients to a government database, which could be accessed for all kinds of reasons that are certainly undemocratic. We see biometric face identification on the public transport systems in Amsterdam. I mean, this is really quite extraordinary that this has developed to such a degree. And we really now need to be aware that we have a very serious problem on our hands. And I want to look at it from a few different angles in today's show. I want to consider it from the angle of the fact that there are big businesses making money out of this. That's one thing to understand. I mean, it is the security industry in the post 9/11 world exploded, and there are so many offshoots of that that all hang on this idea of security and prevention of crime. And the technologies are vast. There are so many different types of systems that have been developed. We've seen all the different types of scanners that have been developed and implemented in airports, and all the different biometric recognition systems, facial recognition, palm prints, thumbprints, all different kinds of ways of identifying, linking an individual to an identity, which is a concept. We need to understand the concept of an identity is something that needs to be understood and perhaps deconstructed a little, because it's not as obvious. It's not as It's not an a priori of human existence that we have to be identified as these kind of unique entities, as if we were prisoners with a number. And we really need to get back to understanding that the need to exhaustively monitor individuals is the type of activity that goes on in prisons. It's the type of activity that goes on also in livestock farms, where you have to keep track of your property. And it is largely about property. The things that you label and mark and track are things that you own. But if we consider the principle fundamentally that we own ourselves, that we are not owned, why should there ever be a need for us to be marked with some indelible branding or imprint? For whose purpose is that? This is what I ask you today to consider. Because you'll see so many arguments for why it's a good thing, so many arguments for why it's a wonderful thing, you know, to have these marvelous new systems of identification and make everything more secure, and you'll be mesmerized by the way in which it is presented to you if you don't stop and just think about it. Think about the fundamentals. Why are you being labeled? Why are you being branded? Why do you have to be so strictly identified? Well, the obvious conclusion comes to mind is that you are owned. Someone else owns you, and they don't want to lose track of you because you are their stock, right? And that is a very, very simple principle that I think anyone can understand, and it is the basic argument that we need to use when we reject all forms of rigid biometric identification. Now, of course, I hear many people will already, I can hear people saying, but wait, we need to have these forms of identification in case someone steals our credit card and uses our identity to get access to our funds or impersonates us and does all these terrible things. Yes, well, you know, those are crimes, ladies and gentlemen. If people do that, that they are crimes. And guess what? Crimes exist. There are such things as criminals in this world. People steal cars. People steal credit cards. People break into your home and steal your stereo. People, for a few bucks, you know, people will steal from a 7-Eleven. And it's wrong, and it needs to be minimized. It needs to be tracked down. People need to be dealt with. I don't think it's okay for people to do these things, right? But what has that got to do with the claim that we need to have more and more and more forms of biometric identification? What has that got to do with that claim? Well, it's very simple. The claim is being made that we need to prevent crime. See, this is a very, very different concept. The claim is now being made that we need to prevent crimes before they can occur. And this is being presented to you as a wonderful thing. Because prevention is better than cure, is it not? So we have to make it more and more difficult. Ultimately, we should make it impossible for you to commit a crime. Now, again, this is a concept that will be simply accepted by so many people because on the face of it, it sounds wonderful. We're going to prevent crime. Isn't it terrific? But then again, you start to think about it a little, don't you? And maybe you remember that movie with Tom Cruise, which was based on a novel by Philip K. Dick, which is based on that very idea that in the future we would prevent crime. And maybe you realize there are some little doubts and uncertainties about whether that is actually a legitimate moral and ethical approach to take. And I want you to consider it in more depth in today's show, because I want to propose to you the concept that if you think you will prevent crime 100%, then you're not allowing people to have the free will to either be law-abiding or not be law-abiding. So the very concept of crime is actually kind of being eradicated by a rewriting of the concept map. And you're basically saying, we're just not going to allow people to be bad. Now, again, a lot of people will think that's great. Don't allow people to be bad. People should all be good. We'll just create a system where people cannot be bad. So what do we even mean by bad and good anymore? I mean, freedom is a basic good. If we're going to deny freedom to people, we are denying a basic good to people. We are doing something which is in itself bad. You could certainly argue that. But you could also certainly argue that if people don't have free will, they cannot be considered to be either good or bad. You're not even giving them the opportunity to be good because you're not allowing them to be bad. If you want to have a good society that is truly good, that is motivated by people, in the hearts of people, to be good and take care of each other, they have to have the free will to choose which path they're going to go down. Those who are trying to create this panopticon surveillance state that limits people's behavior and prevents crime don't even want people to be human anymore. That's what I propose to you, and that's what I want you to have a think about. As we go to break, you're with Truth News Radio Australia. My name's Herriwood Fenton, and I will be back right after the break for more.
Are you getting fed up with all the disinformation, deception, spin, propaganda, half-truths and downright lies in mainstream news? Looking for something different? Visit Truth News Radio Australia, www.truthnews.com.au, and may the truth set you free.
Welcome back, you with Truth News Radio. And do check us out on the internet if you get a chance at truthnews.com.au. Do try and subscribe to our podcasts. They're all freely available there, and we've got several years' worth of pretty interesting material for you to plow through if you're a newcomer to the show. Now, today we're talking about biometrics, we're talking about surveillance, we're going to be talking about Bitcoin in the next hour. And I've got something interesting to tell you about Bitcoin, which is just a tad disturbing, ladies and gentlemen. An article here from the 21st of April on biometricupdate.com. A biometric Bitcoin ATM has been unveiled at a mall in Sydney, Australia. This is the first of many to be rolled out across the country, and it uses a combination of biometrics to register and verify user identities. Now, this has also been reported by The Guardian, and I've got an article here titled Australia's First Bitcoin Automatic Teller Opens for Business in Sydney. And it says here, the machine scans their government-issued photo ID, such as a driver's license, and uses facial recognition technology to verify that their face matches the photo. Users can also scan their palm on the machine, which is used along with a PIN and their phone number to verify their identity in future transactions. So, Bitcoin, which has been seen as the great liberator, as a technology which frees people to spend their money without Big Brother looking over their shoulder, is now using biometric ID. Now, you may say, well, that's fine. It's just a system of identification. It's not going to be used in any kind of Big Brother sense. You might argue that. Let's have a look at another article here from Wired.com, and this is dated 24 April 2014. The world's first Bitcoin debit card is almost here. Bitcoin may be the future of digital money, but it has a problem in the United States. Why use it to buy anything when millions of merchants already accept debit and credit cards? Today, if you want to buy a bottle of lemonade with bitcoins, you need to scan a QR code with your phone or email, and that is the way in which you buy or sell using a bitcoin. For most people, buying with bitcoins is not as easy as Visa or MasterCard. But that's set to change in the next 2 months. Zappo, a company that offers online Bitcoin wallets, says it's 2 months away from introducing the first debit card that will let you spend your Bitcoins at any place that takes Visa or MasterCard. It's a sign of Bitcoin's growing maturity, and look at how the digital currency is slowly integrating with the mainstream financial services industry thanks to a raft of venture-backed Bitcoin startups that are now coming online. Here's how it works. Zappo, a Bitcoin wallet provider, is in the process of becoming a debit card issuer on one of the major credit card networks. That means that, like your bank, Zappo can issue you a debit card number and an expiration date. You get the card number for free. If you want them to send you some plastic so you can gas up or buy beer at the corner store with your bitcoins, then they'll charge you $15. When you use the Zappo card, the credit card number checks in with Zappo, which approves or declines the transaction, depending on how much Bitcoin you have in your wallet. It then sells the Bitcoin on the Bitstamp exchange and pays out the merchants, just like any other card issuer. Well, that all sounds wonderful, doesn't it? But hang on. We were just talking there about the biometrics, we're talking about the freedom of Bitcoin, we're talking about how they're now bringing in biometric identification to use these Bitcoin ATMs, and we now see that Bitcoin will be accessible through a debit card, which will be simply another arm of the credit card networks. I'm beginning to wonder about Bitcoin. whether it really is about this wonderful freedom that we've been told. And I'll certainly be discussing this in more depth with Josh Jackson in the second hour. But it looks to me, folks, as if Bitcoin is in fact, it's kind of coming in stealth. It looks to me like a bit of a Trojan. It looks like it was brought in as a wonderful system that we would believe in and trust. Now, either it was hijacked or was always intended to be used in this way, but it is now going to be, well, they're calling it the future of money. I see a time coming when Bitcoin will actually be the global medium of exchange, a new international currency, and it looks like it's going to be part of the control system by which all those who buy or sell are forced to identify themselves biometrically. I don't think that's a good thing, folks. Now, let's just get back to this question about identification and security. And I want to just do a thought experiment. I want you to think about your key. Most of us have a key that we use to access our homes. And a key is a very old-fashioned system, very easy to hack and very easy to get around, yet we all still use them. We have a key, the key fits a lock, the lock is on our door, and when we come home, we get our key out and we open the door. Now, our key will not open other people's doors, and other people's keys will not open our doors. Well, how insecure is that? Isn't that ridiculous, folks? I mean, how are you going to prevent crime if we simply allow people to just use this very, very easily undermined system of keys and locks? All you have to do to get around the system is steal someone's key, take it to a locksmith, get it copied, and then you can get access to their home. So what do we do? I mean, do we put biometric identification systems on all our doors? Is that what we're proposing? That I have to identify myself to my own door so I can get in? It's my home. Why should I have to do that? And this is the basic concept. It's your life. It's your money. You own yourself. Why do you have to identify yourself to yourself? Now, just consider this question about keys and locks and how we secure our homes. Again, it's very easy for someone to steal your key. But you know what? Even without stealing the key, they can still get into your home. They can kick your door down. Absolutely. The police do it all the time. All you need is a big sledgehammer and you can knock someone's door down. Oh, goodness me, what a security hazard. Oh, people's doors can be knocked down. What are we going to do? Build all the doors out of solid steel in all the world so no one could ever knock a door down. This is what crime prevention leads to. It's an insane concept to think that you're going to prevent crime. No, you're not going to prevent it. You're never going to prevent it. And the reason why we have keys and locks is it's a signal to others to say, this is my private property, don't step over this line. If you do, you're breaking the law. If you do, you're going to be in trouble if we catch you. We might not catch you. Of course, you can't catch everyone. It's a signal. It's a symbol. That's what locked doors are. That's what doors are. They're not crime prevention systems, right? In a civil society where we expect people to obey the law, we also give them the freedom possibly to break the law. Because if you don't have the freedom to break the law, you can't have the freedom to be law-abiding and good. It's a very simple argument, but also very deep. Do consider it. We're going to break. We'll be right back with a very interesting debate on climate change. Don't go away. Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. Today I've been looking at some questions to do with biometrics, surveillance, and Bitcoin, and cryptocurrencies, and the future of credit cards. And I will be engaging in that topic in the second hour in more depth with my guest Josh Jackson. But for the remainder of this hour, I would like to bring you some clips from a recent debate between Clive Palmer and Ross Garnaut on the carbon tax. It's a very, very important topic for Australians. Of course, the current incumbent government in Australia has a commitment to scrap the carbon tax, but there is a need for them to get a certain number of votes in the Senate in order to make that possible. And there is by no means guaranteed that the carbon tax will be abolished because these critical Senate votes are not yet secured. Now, the ABC has aired a debate between Clive Palmer and Ross Garnaut. Clive Palmer, leader of the Palmer United Party, adamantly against the carbon tax, and an interesting guy and someone who I have a lot of respect for, even though I know he's a greedy corporate billionaire and he's in the mining industry, which I know does a lot of bad things. However, he is apparently not owned by the corporate fascist masters that would rule the world, and he has stood out with some very independent views that have come forward in the media, and he's certainly been lambasted for them. And he has been dead against the carbon tax 100%, and he's even vehemently opposed to the Liberal Party's alternate schemes for carbon abatement, which because he's a sceptic, he's a true sceptic. He doesn't accept the position that that carbon dioxide is a problem. And as such, he has my respect, because what we see with the Liberal Party is they're playing this double game. They're saying, well, they're trying to appease the climate sceptics by promising to abolish the carbon tax, but then they're saying, well, we're going to bring in this direct action program because actually we do believe in all the concepts behind the carbon tax. It doesn't add up. It's dishonest. It's manipulative. They're playing the game. So let's now play you some of this debate, and I haven't actually had a chance to watch it myself till now, but I may stop it from moment to moment and give you some of my thoughts as we progress. So here we go. Debate on ABC between Clive Palmer and Ross Garnaut on ABC Late Line.
Well, just this week, economist Ross Garnaut warned at business launch, that business lunch that should be, that the Abbott government could blow a $7 billion hole in its budget if it succeeds in getting rid of the carbon tax. Meanwhile, MP and miner Clive Palmer was reluctantly handing over some of the millions of dollars he owes to the federal government in carbon tax, a tax he wants declared unconstitutional by the High Court. Well, in the run-up to this weekend's Senate election in Western Australia, which could decide the fate of the carbon tax, Ross Garnaut and Clive Palmer have agreed to debate the carbon pricing and climate change systems. They join us now from our Perth studio. Welcome to both of you.
Hello, Tony.
How are you?
Very well, thank you. Ross Garnaut, first to you. You say the world is watching this Senate election in WA, so what's at stake from your point of view?
Yes, the world's been taking substantial action, the United States, China, the countries of Europe, Japan, the other major developing countries, ever since a new approach was adopted in Cancun. There's a big effort on, led by the United States, China, France, who will be the hosts, Britain, Germany, to get a strong result out of a new UN meeting in Paris in 2015. Australia and, to a lesser extent, Canada are now seen as drags on that process. And it's very much in Australia's interest that we get a good outcome in 2015.
Okay, let's just pause it right there. Australia and Canada are seen as drags on that process. Oh, diddums. You know, that's just so terrible, isn't it? We're drags on this process of creating a global form of global governance with centralized systems where taxation will be fed through to this overarching system based on completely unproven science, which we have seen has led to all kinds of restrictions and all kinds of undermining of basic democratic rights and freedoms of people in countries where the extreme positions of Agenda 21, climate change, preemptive actions have been implemented. So he then says it's in Australia's best interests. Well, I think that's a complete outright lie. I think that's doublespeak. I think it's actually in Australia's worst interests. It's in the best interests of those who think they own us, for us to fall into line, absolutely. But is it in Australia's best interests? Well, it begs the question, doesn't it? He's just saying it's in Australia's best interest. But this is meant to be a debate. I mean, there's so much wrong with what he's saying there. It's just incredible. I mean, this man is unbelievable, actually, when you consider it. He's actually a banker, by the way, and he was the man who wrote the report, the Garneau report, that Kevin Rudd relied on. And, you know, he's not even a scientist. He's a banker. Anyway, let's continue now with the debate, so-called.
Whether we get a good outcome depends on the survival of the current laws, the Senate election in WA will have an influence on the chances of survival.
Yeah, just very briefly, you say there's widespread international concern at Australia's changing climate policy. What's the evidence of that?
Well, first, in consultations I had in London and in Germany in January, strong expressions of concern were made by people who are close to the governments. And John Kerry, Secretary for State for the United States, has recently given instruction to the Department of State and to all of the U.S. ambassadors abroad that climate change and a good result in Paris in 2015 is the number one foreign policy priority of the United States. Crimea is important, Syria is important, but the number one priority, says the U.S. Secretary for State, is climate change policy. And Australia is seen as lagging behind.
Okay, Clive Palmer, do you care if the world is watching, and do you care what these countries think about what you ultimately do?
Well, of course we care, but I think you've got to really understand the truth about all this. The Australian carbon tax is totally different to other carbon regimes throughout the world. We've got the ETS trading system in Europe, and the price of carbon there is about $5 a tonne, and here it's going to go to about $40 a tonne. So you're not comparing like with like. Secondly, the air moves around the world. We need a global solution to this problem. We as Australians can't solve that problem, but we don't want to send our industries overseas. We don't want to have Australians losing their jobs and seeing their going to Indonesia with no effect on the carbon sequestrance at all. And worse still, we pretend, like Mr. Garneau does, that we're doing actually something about it by having a carbon tax, when in reality we're doing nothing about changing how much carbon there is in the world. We need a global solution. We don't need a piecemeal effort that destroys jobs, ruins our investment, and puts up the price of electricity so much for every Australian family.
Actually, let me just pause it there, because I may have actually misrepresented Clive Palmer's views. I had thought that he was a complete sceptic in regard to carbon dioxide. Listening to him there, it appears that he may in fact be somewhat of a believer in anthropogenic CO2-induced climate change. I do apologise for perhaps misrepresenting his views, but we'll continue now with his speech.
Let's go to Ross Garneau for a response to that, and the debate will begin.
Yes, Tony, Mr. Palmer's dead right that there has to be a global solution, and the global community is doing something. The United States reducing emissions by 17% by 2020 from 2005 levels, China reducing carbon intensity of production by 40 to 45% over the same time period, Europe doing a great deal, Japan, Korea, Brazil, South Africa. So the rest of the world's doing things, and we've got to do our fair share, and the current policies will allow us to do our fair share. If we pull back, we won't be able to do that. It's true that at the moment our carbon price is above Europe, but with the existing law, our prices will go a bit below Europe, about 7% below Europe from the middle of 2015, when we link to Europe and also allow some purchases of developing country.
Just pause it there. We're going to break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. We'll be right back. Tuned to Truth News Radio. It's great to be with you today. I'm playing you a clip here from a debate between Clive Palmer and Ross Garnaut on the carbon tax in Australia. And we've been listening there to Ross Garnaut talking about his very strongly held view. Of course, he's a very much entrenched insider of the banking industry, former head of the one of the major banks in Australia that deals with the mining resources. And of course, Clive Palmer, a mining magnate. You could say they're both insiders. Now, I had assumed that Clive Palmer was a bit more of a sceptic than what he appears to be in this interview. He is definitely opposing the carbon tax, and he's definitely opposing the Abbott government's direct action scheme. So I'm not quite sure what his philosophical or scientific angle on this is. We'll perhaps find out as we go through the interview today. We've got another segment here to play for you. Before we head to the second hour, where I'll be getting Josh Jackson on to talk about Bitcoin and biometrics. But we'll just return now to the debate, and we're listening here to Ross Garnaut, so I'll return to that segment.
Carbon credits. Well, we could, if Mr. Palmer is concerned about the disparity between Australia and Europe, which will disappear in a year's time, he could advocate bringing forward the linkage to Europe to July the 1st this year, and there'd be a Senate majority for doing that if the government supported it right now. So if that's the worry, we can cure that problem very quickly. Third point, effects on competitiveness of Australian industries. The existing package, the carbon pricing arrangement, goes to great care to make sure that Australian emissions-intensive industries aren't disadvantaged. For example, take the nickel industry. It is very carbon-intensive, high emissions. Well, the way the compensation is worked out, the nickel industry, firms in it, get 94.5% for the first year of the scheme of permits free. But that 94.5% is based on average emissions before the carbon price came into existence. And if you reduce your emissions, or if at the beginning you were below average, you can actually make a profit. You get more free permits than than you actually require. And I'll just continue for a moment, Tony.
Yeah, just a moment.
The average in nickel is the average.
Okay.
Go ahead. Clive Palmer, I think what's being said there by Professor Garnaut is that if you'd actually had a more emissions friendly, or if you'd actually managed to reduce your emissions at your refinery in Townsville, you could have actually made a profit rather than end up paying out large sum in the carbon tax that you've just written a cheque for, evidently.
Isn't it ludicrous to have a carbon tax that makes you think you're doing something, when in reality you give all the industries a free permit, so they'd have to pay less than they can make a profit? You know, that's just a ludicrous policy. And what I'm concerned about is the loss of jobs.
Can I just interrupt you there? Isn't that only the case if you don't reduce your emissions?
Can I answer what you've said, and then you can have a chat? But it's my turn now. And I'm concerned about the people and families that are getting unemployed, both at my refinery and all around Australia. It might matter to Mr. Garner that it happens in 2015, but I'm concerned about 2014, the mums and dads that have got kids to look after themselves. That's what I'm concerned about. And it's just ludicrous to say that we haven't got a global solution with this false carbon tax that's imposed. It's just another method for raising money by the government. Now, we know that 97% of the world's carbon comes from natural sources. Why don't we have money to look at how we can reduce the overall carbon signature by reducing it from nature, not just from industry? It's entirely wrong-focused.
Let's go back to Ross Garnaut on that. Now, Clive Palmer's repeated this claim many times over a number of years, that 97% of CO2 actually comes from natural sources, only 3% from human-created CO2. What's your answer to that?
Oh, staying with nickel just for a second, Tony. The average for Australia is the average of very high emissions from a Townsville refinery and very low emissions from West Australian refineries. WA cleaner nickel refining can actually make a profit from the free permits. If you got rid of the carbon price, you'd take money from West Australian refineries and give it to a dirty refinery up in Townsville. But on the question
of
natural...
That's subjective. That's
well, it's just not Mr.
true.
Mr. Palmer,
the refineries in Western Australia work on a different type of ore than we do. We work on laterite ore. They work on sulphide ore. Totally different processes, totally different operation. That's the reality of it.
Okay, let's draw a line under the comparison between the different refineries for a minute, because we actually have bigger fish to fry. The claim from Clive Palmer was that only 3% of CO2 is actually coming from man-made sources, therefore it's not a problem.
Well, for thousands of years, there was a balance between natural emissions and natural absorption of emissions. The big increase in human emissions from burning fossil fuels since the Industrial Revolution and chopping down trees has changed that balance. So it's the human-induced changes that create the climate change problem. It's why there's been nearly a degree of warming in the last half century. It's why West Australia in the southwest, the beautiful natural areas of southwest West Australia are being damaged by a combination of drying and warming. It's the human-induced component that makes the difference. The natural components were in balance.
Clive Palmer, I think you were suggesting there that that I'd put words in your mouth. Are you saying that, man-made CO2 is actually a problem?
What I'm trying to say is that CO2 is a problem generally. So if 97% of it comes from nature and 3% comes from man, and we say we've got to reduce it by 1%, we shouldn't just look at the 3%, the minority section coming from human enterprise. We need to look at the whole concept. If 1% or 2% comes down from nature, surely that's a good thing, and that brings us back into a balance. It's the total carbon balance you have to look at.
Clive Palmer,
but we're just focusing on this
3%. Can I ask you a very basic question? Do you believe the consensus...
Sure.
Scientific views set out in the latest IPCC report that climate change impacts due to global warming will have especially serious impacts on Australia?
I just want to pause it there. I think this is a very interesting debate, and I'm not quite sure what the objective of Clive Palmer's angle on this is. I think it could be that he is trying to bypass being labelled as a denier. Because I do certainly recall from his previous views that he has expressed that he is sceptical about anthropogenic climate change. He's very studiously avoiding denying the construct. And what we see here at this point in the debate is we see the presenter, Tony Jones, actually demanding a statement of faith. He's basically asking Clive Palmer, do you believe? This is actually a religious question. This is like proposing to someone, do you believe in the sacrament? Do you believe in the catechism? Do you believe that Jesus died and was resurrected on the third day? And I'm not saying I'm not against religion. I'm just saying that this is really a religious thing. Now, of course, he's using the word consensus, which has been so completely debunked as a false argument. And yet, here we see, again, on mainstream television, a very, very popular primetime TV show, and we see this consensus concept being put forward as framing a belief system. You must believe the consensus. This is the consensus of the priesthood of those who are called scientists, those who wear the white garb, those who have examined the entrails of chickens and done their modelling based on what they discovered to tell us. And are you questioning their consensus? Well, let's see how Clive responds.
No, I don't believe that's so. There's been global warming for a long time. I mean, all of Ireland was covered by ice at one time. There were no human inhabitants in Ireland. That's how the world has been going over millions and billions of years, and Ross Garnaut knows that's true. So I think that's part of the natural cycle.
So I'm just asking you this because this research that I'm talking about is based on what 309 scientists concluded from 70 countries, and the summary for the policymakers has to be agreed line by 115 countries. I mean, that's the sort of consensus that you're rejecting here.
Well, I think it's Camels was designed by a committee. With so many people, and you're really not going to get anything worthwhile. You need to have a proper report with people that can do something. But look,
I've got to interrupt you there. A proper report.
Every now and then, come on, we'll have a fight if you want to. But why don't you just shut up while I can say what I want to say? I'm saying that 100% of carbon, we've got to reduce it. 97% comes from nature. Let's reduce it. Let's look at both areas. Not just look at industry, not just take away our jobs, up our electricity prices. Let's care about the people that are living on the planet right now, the pensioners that are going to pay higher electricity. All those things are concerned to me. And let's each of us respect each other so we can each talk fairly about this issue.
Well, can I now ask the question I was going to ask? If you don't agree
sure.
in the consensus of scientists who are supposedly experts in this field, who would you take advice from on such a matter?
Well, I can get a group of scientists together, Tony, and pay them whatever I want to and come up with any solution. That's what's been happening all over the world in a whole range of things. There's a long history of that happening in the drug industry and a whole range of industries in the United States.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there. This is a really interesting debate, and you can see Clive Palmer losing it there a bit, telling Tony Jones to shut up. He's trying to weave an argument to get around the label of denier, but, he didn't quite succeed there. I think, unfortunately, it's a tough call. We are going to break. I'll be back at the beginning of the next hour with Josh Jackson. Really interesting hour coming up, so please stay with us.